This piece was brought to you by the Tabard Inn, tabardinn.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Opinion.
Is there anything inherently wrong with the way snack foods are developed and marketed? How much responsibility should rest on the consumer versus the manufacturer in matters of labeling and marketing? Do the food industry's attempts to offer more nutritious products reflect a genuine concern for public health? MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink, held a roundtable called Whose Responsibility? Marketing and the Ethics of Big Food on June 19, 2014, at NYU Global Center's Grand Hall in New York City. The roundtable tackled these questions through a lively debate among experts in market research, consumer advocacy, and public health. Panelists were Michelle Simon, president of Eat Drink Politics, Howard Moskowitz, chairman of the Institute for Competitive Excellence at Queen's College, Christina Roberto, assistant professor of social and behavioral sciences and nutrition at Harvard School of Public Health, and Derek Yak, executive director for the Vitality Institute. The panel was moderated by Dave Arnold, founder of the Museum of Food and Drink. We're proud to share with you a recording of the event in its entirety. We also live tweeted the event. Check out our coverage by searching Twitter, hashtag MOFAD Roundtable. Here's the recording. Enjoy.
So welcome, everyone. My name is Emma Bost. I'm the program director of the Museum of Food and Drink, and really excited to see so many people here. We're thrilled to have such a big turnout. This is our third MOFAD roundtable. If you guys don't know what roundtable is, it's an ongoing series of debates on current and controversial issues in food policy, kind of looking at issues at the intersection of agriculture, science and technology, health and nutrition. We did a debate on GMOs in April at the Food Book Fair, and also one on the New York City soda regulation in December at the CUNY School of Public Health. Thank you so much to NYU, first of all, for hosting us in this gorgeous space. Also thanks to Heritage Radio Network, who's here tonight recording the debate. They're going to post the audio on their website, which is heritageradionetwork.com. And also a special thank you to Alyssa Moran, who I believe is here in the audience. She is an amazing MOFAD volunteer and has been helping with a lot of the planning and research for these events over the past year or so. And she's going to be moving on, actually, to Harvard School of Public Health in the fall, so we will miss her, but thanks for your help, Alyssa. So the theme of tonight's conversation is responsibility. Namely, is there a role for the food industry in furthering public health? Recently, several major food manufacturers have made commitments to health, namely in terms of reformulating their products to have lower levels of salt, sugar, and fat. These three substances, as Michael Moss reported in his eponymous book, are often identified as key culprits in the public health crisis. But do these developments reflect a genuine concern for health on the part of the food industry? Are they motivated out of fear, perhaps, based on increased scrutiny that the public generally has towards the food industry these days? And is it possible to align social good, health, increased environmental sustainability, social responsibility with the bottom line? And is the food industry possibly positioned to actually make widespread change in terms of public health in this country and worldwide, given its massive reach and influence? So these are some of the questions we'll be tackling in today's debate. MOFAD Roundtable is a conversation that is intended to draw on the public. And so in your programs, there are surveys, and we would love it if you would just take a few seconds to fill those out after the event, and we'll have volunteers collecting them at the back. It's really important to us to have your feedback on the event. And then finally, if you enjoyed tonight's program, and hopefully you will, we would really love it if you could support MOFAD in any way possible. We're a nonprofit and are trying to create a multifaceted educational institution here in New York. You can go to donate.mofad.org to help us produce more MOFAD roundtables, produce exhibits, and generally keep our programming going. Quickly, I'd like to introduce our panel. I'm not going to go into their bios. Those are in your programs. We have Derek Yak, who's the executive director of the Vitality Institute, Christina Roberto from Harvard School of Public Health, Howard Moskowitz, who's the chairman of iNovum, and Michelle Simon, who is the president of Eat, Drink, Politics, Dave Arnold, who's the founder of MOFAD, will be moderating our debate. So thank you so much.
Okay, the rules. You'll all have 2 minutes to give kind of an opening spiel on the topic at hand. Emma will hold up a little sign saying when you're done. Then I'll probably toss a question to each one of you in some order. You will answer it, and then it's up to the rest to then respond. I'm not going to stop anyone from saying whatever they want or talking, you know, to or having a conversation, because that's what we want. Just keep it respectful, because otherwise I'll have to come in and lay down the law, which I don't want to do. All right? So we'll start with Michelle. We'll go down.
All right. Thank you for bringing us all together to have, I'm sure, will be a respectful and invigorating conversation. I'm looking forward to it. So the way I think about this question of the role of the food industry and, you know, who's really responsible, this debate that we're having right now, and the national discourse that's going on, is it up to the consumer to just eat right, or is it up to the food industry to provide healthy food? To me, that's it has a lot of built-in assumptions that I think need to be unpacked. So the biggest assumption is that there's equal footing, right? So that somehow consumers and industry are both equal players in this game, if you will, of how to eat right. And nothing could be farther from the truth. Right? We have a food industry that spends billions of dollars a year on everything from R&D to figure out how to engineer products to get you to keep eating more and more, to focus groups, to deep psychological research to figure out how to get you to eat more and more, and what color to use on the packaging, and that could go on and on and on. So you have this imbalance of an industry that is doing what it's supposed to do, sell more product. That's what they're actually legally obligated to do. And that's an important component to understand, that publicly traded companies' first legal obligation is to their shareholders. So this idea of, oh, well, food companies should just do the right thing, well, actually, they could get sued by giving more over to social benefit than to economic benefit. So it's really important to keep that in mind. And then the other assumption is that government kind of gets left out of the conversation too often, right? That it's just a matter of consumers and industry. But all the while industry is spending billions of dollars trying to get you to eat more and more, they're also spending lots of money, almost as much, lobbying to make sure there's a regulatory-friendly environment that they can push their agenda through. And so, again, not exactly a level playing field. And so we also have to ask, what is the role of government? And maybe we can include that in the conversation. So what is industry's responsibility, right? If really all they're about is making money. For me, I look at it as a lawyer first and as someone who wants industry to take responsibility, but in terms of how they market their products, because I don't think that industry should make healthier food. However, they should obey the law, and they should not engage in deceptive marketing. That, to me, is the most important component. And they're not doing that right now. They're pretending to make healthier food, right, calling sugar Pepsi natural. They're making whole grain Reese's Puff cereal, right, all these deceptive practices that I really think have to stop. Finally, they are engaging in what I think is both morally repugnant and possibly illegal activity in marketing to children. So that's how I look at this issue. Thank you.
Wow. There are really three aspects. First aspect is, what does the public think? And we seem to be in a world where companies are bashed, sometimes for a good reason, sometimes for not such good reason. But there seems to be a popular baiting culture in America and perhaps now in the world. So we have to ask, how much is being brought by the desire to sell books, sell one's services, have a public platform? Or is there really a venal culture in the corporation where there's a little cabal of men and women trying to fake everybody out? It's a real question. I don't have an answer for that. Number two is, what's really happening in the corporation? What's the job of the corporation? As Michelle said, the job of the corporation is to create good food that will sell to people within the limits of the law. Not much more than that. Food corporations are not NGOs who are set up to make public more healthy. They're set up to offer a series of products and services to people at a profit, not without breaking the law. To the degree that these things that they offer are health-oriented, it's wonderful. To the degree to which they're within the limits of the law, that's good. They should not break the law, but they're not set up as do-gooder organizations. And the third is the government. What's the role of the government? Should the government be a watchdog? Should the food industry be regulated? Well, we know that every regulated economy in Europe, centrally planned regulated economy, ended up failing. If the government gets its hands on the food industry, God forbid, will we have a food industry that's worse than our worst nightmares? Will we, in fact, have a food industry that's given over to the venality of the do-gooders who really are evil incarnate? And the final thing is, what's the role of the consumer? Why is the consumer so damn stupid? Do we have people running around who know nothing? Maybe it's time that we spent all this money on educating the consumer properly, rather than railing against the food industry for the lobbyists and for the advertising agencies and for the focus group moderators. Why don't we take some of that money and have our government, our blessed government in Washington, as well as all over the states, spend a little bit more money properly educating the consumer, and not just railing around, oh, woe is me.
Hi, I'm delighted to be here. I just have some prepared remarks I'm going to read. So, apart from economic crisis, no country has yet turned around its obesity epidemic. Sure, there are positive pockets of change, some flattening of childhood obesity in cities and countries with very high rates, but even where we see progress, we see widening inequality. This week, California's proposed bill to put warning labels on soda and other sugary drinks was voted down. I was reading an article about the bill that quoted an opponent representing the beverage industry, and he argued that the bill unfairly singled out soft drinks and that, quote, other factors, including a lack of exercise, genetics, and unhealthy diets, contribute in concert to ballooning obesity and diabetes rates. This argument is often made. And I share the quote with you not because I believe we must place warning labels on sugary drinks, that's an open scientific question we need more data on, but because this kind of reasoning represents a major barrier to progress. The argument is not untrue. Obesity is complicated, and it's difficult to build the scientific case that we should intervene on any one factor. But by that logic, we are left doing nothing, and we cannot afford to do nothing. Instead, we must start somewhere. And those starting points should be where the scientific data are strongest. Right now, it suggests targeting sugary drinks. The theme of this roundtable is big food. I believe the food industry has an important role to play in addressing obesity, but I believe the path to success will largely be through policy. As a society, we have agreed that government has some role to play to protect the health and safety of its citizens. We are supposed to wear seatbelts, there is fluoride in our water, children must be immunized, and we tax cigarettes and alcohol. We enact policies when there are strong forces influencing people to make choices they don't want to make, choices that are misaligned with their self-interest. In the case of obesity, many people want to be healthy. They want to be disease-free. But so many factors outside our control influence us to eat poorly. This is the time when environmental forces and self-interest are at odds, when policy can level the playing field to help people make responsible food choices. Certainly, food companies can change the context in which they eat. They could offer smaller portion sizes and change prices, but they lack strong financial incentives to do so. They are ethically obligated to be profitable. And it doesn't mean that they can't make meaningful changes, and certainly companies have done that. But I think although we need efforts from diverse stakeholders, including the food industry, to reverse obesity, more than anything, we need policy changes.
Thanks. I think one of the critical things to think about is the questions we've heard here that companies are legally and ethically responsible to maximize short-term shareholder return. That's actually incorrect legally, and it's incorrect economically, besides being obviously morally unacceptable to many. But let's forget the moral aspect. When I was at PepsiCo, the CEO asked the general counsel, what is the legal responsibility of a good company? To specifically ask, address the question of what Milton Friedman said. Milton Friedman, you may remember as a Nobel Prize winner, started the story that people haven't really corrected, that the sole purpose of a company is to maximize short-term shareholder return. So what is a legal case? It's been tested under court law in the US for 100 years. And every single time, the courts have ruled in favor of doing the right thing, even that it may take longer and it may minimize the value of shares, the money going to the shareholders in the short term. The most famous cases, just some to think about, was when Ford sued the Dodge brothers, or Dodge brothers sued Ford because Ford wanted to raise the wages of workers, and they said raising the wages takes money out of our pockets. Or when the Wrigley family was sued by the Cubs because they wanted the lights put up at the stadium, and the Wrigley brothers said it's more important to worry about long-term neighborly relations than to maximize short-term revenue of getting into night games. Wrigley won. And there have been case after case written up by Lynn Stout in the Columbia, in the Cornell Review, and even by the general counsel of PepsiCo recently in the Loyola Law Journal. The legal case is clear. There is no legal responsibility to maximize short-term return. The economic case has got even stronger. We now know that the companies who do the right thing, invest in longer-term creation of value, recognize that they are created to exist in perpetuity, not for tomorrow, and act accordingly, in other words, become better stewards of the environment, start investing in R&D, and start changing their portfolios, show bigger returns on the bottom line. Eccles and people like Michael Porter and Mark Cramer have shown that, and that's the very basis of what's called creating shared value. As we talk, I'll show that this has not just been regarded as theoretical discussion, it's now empowered CEOs to act in the long term. But there is one big scary threat that remains out there, and that is the activist investor. Big, wealthy activist investors who are super greedy and who do actually want to go back to the days of Milton Friedman and do hold corporations to account when they actually spend on R&D or do the right thing. That is an issue that is rarely discussed in the public health community, and I can see how it hampers a lot of the progress we could see.
Well, thank you for those statements. I'll start back over here, I think, with Michelle. Now, regardless of whether we're going to talk short-term or long-term profit, right, you say that the goal of the corporation, admittedly, is to maximize returns over the long or the short haul, and that this leads to an imbalance that needs to be addressed with government regulation. Well, what's the limit of that? If we're to remain a free market economy, what's the limit of government regulation that you think is reasonable? And at that point, will we be able to pull the profit motivations of the corporation in line with what you think is in balance with public health?
Okay. So here we go with the assumptions again. We are not a free market economy. We are an economy that is propped up by government regulations right now. So this idea that, oh, my God, we don't want government telling us what to eat. Well, guess what? Sorry to break it to you all, but the government is telling you what to eat right now. That's exactly why a cheeseburger costs less than a salad. Okay, that is absolutely related to government policies. I don't mean just, you know, the attention has mostly been around agricultural subsidies, and there's some evidence to show that's not even the biggest factor. There are so many ways that companies get tax breaks, all kinds of government regulations that go into the decisions around what we eat, what's marketed. I mean, you name it, the government is involved in some way. And that means local, state, federal government, even international regulations affect what foods are available to us. So the question isn't, what are the limits of government policy? The question is, like, that's a scary thing. The question is, how can we have a better balance of government regulation to promote good health, find the proper balance between, yes, of course, we don't want to live in, my God, you know, I know this, the scary thing is living in some kind of socialized state, but there's a balance to be struck between allowing for some free market solutions and competitiveness, et cetera, and having a government that protects the people. That's really the proper role of government, to balance economic interests with the public interest.
Well, before I let it go to the other thing, to more the point of the question, what would that look like? What would that look like in a system where we actually have to feed a large amount of people for a relatively small amount of money? Like, what would that actually look like?
Well, there's 1,000 different possibilities for how to go about changing current government regulation. I mean, I just put out a report about the dairy industry and in cahoots with our U.S. Department of Agriculture to promote the likes of Taco Bell, Domino's, Pizza, and McDonald's. Why is the U.S. government mandating a checkoff program that promotes fast food? So that's just one example, right? There's 1,000 examples, and people are trying to look at, you know, soda taxes. I mean, there's all kinds of ideas out there. The point is that we can't let this idea of big government telling you what to do carry the public messaging when what we're talking about is, again, getting back to a balance where industry is regulated in a way that doesn't promote ill health but actually promotes good health.
Instead of, well, I think this is a very impassioned argument. I'd like to suggest that it might be a lot easier to re-educate consumers to want to live and eat better than it is to change the entire industry. I think you can. I think it's more emotionally attractive to people to bash the government and to bash companies. I can see it with everybody's language and body that it's so exciting to call people, you're guilty, you do this, you do that. Why don't we spend the money, as I said in my introductory remarks, why don't we spend the money trying to figure out what to educate the consumer, how to educate the consumer, so the consumer actually wants to live and eat better. We're assuming that we have this ravenous group of people running about grabbing Taco Bell cheeseburgers and whatever, and you have to restrain them. Why don't we treat people like adults and reprogram their head rather than reprogramming the government? Anybody who's ever gone to a civil service office knows that it's a hell of a lot easier to walk out than it is to wait 3 hours. And how do you do that? How do you spend the money to teach people? It's not so hard. Madison Avenue knows how to promote cheeseburgers. Why don't we take the same creative brains in Madison Avenue and promote living healthfully? We don't think about that, except as a minor takeaway.
Just in response to that, so Howard, I like your point, and I think about that a lot. I'm also a clinician who works with patients to try to help them lose weight. And what the data show and what I experience anecdotally is that actually many people do want to be healthy. 50% of people at any time are currently on a diet. And so it's not necessarily this lack of people needing to be reprogrammed to care about that. People care about it a lot. I think what we're seeing in the data is that the educational interventions that we've tried just fallen short. They haven't been successful. So I think you're right. We need some creative thinking around how to educate better. But I think in conjunction, in the absence of that right now, we need to partner and dual strategies that also focus on changing the environment.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with Michelle about the fact that we really have a system that is where the incentives are really malaligned. I mean, the most classic ones are the way we have a agriculture department whose main role is to increase yield and productivity and to ignore the nutritional consequences of what that means, and so go off and produce cheaper and cheaper foods, which become grown and supported through support policies and structures, and get consumed in excess compared to a wider range of fruits, vegetables, nuts, and grains, where the relative price has been rising for the last few years compared to soy, corn, grain, and many of those products. That's a distortion that has happened not just over a year or 2 years. It's been decades. Clearly, that needs to be addressed. And there are many of those examples out there. I think Howard is also right that you have to work on both ends. That's going to take decades to unravel, but we need to start now doing it. Consumer change, though, is tough. And I have a bunch of colleagues in the room who understand the world of behavioral economics far better than I ever will. and understand that to really make consumer changes work, we need to recognize the irrationality of our own decision processes. And when it comes to food, I'm sure Howard knows this is particularly a case. Faced with a tempting cookie at the back, I noticed he took it. he did comment to me that it's a pity they didn't have bananas and carrots, but you didn't give us bananas and carrots. A behavioral economist would have given us bananas and carrots, and if they wanted the cookies, put them in a dark corner over there. That would have changed the consumption trends in this room and consumer behavior dramatically, immediately, and don't tell me it can't be done. We know it actually happens. In our own group we work with, we found if you discount healthy foods by a lot, up to 25%, no big surprise, consumption of healthy foods goes up, and that's good for health and it's good for the environment, by the way. So there are many things we could be doing. The thing that I would disagree with Howard about is to get the marketers to change their marketing practices. Those marketers are skilled at selling stuff under the aura of fun, very tasty, sugary, whatever. Those marketers are not going to lead us to the healthier foods and the healthier lifestyle. We need a new breed of marketers who actually understand how complex it will be to make the change.
Can I respond quickly to the education piece? So since you brought it up twice, I want to give my wrap on education. So it's not like we're not trying to educate people. We are. There are many programs going on. They've been going on for years. And we also have good experience from other public health interventions. So when you have an industry like tobacco or alcohol or, in tonight's discussion, food, that is spending so much money getting people to do the wrong thing, it's extremely difficult, nearly impossible, to expect the trivial amount of, you know, public health pennies that go into educational programs to compete. Now, you're talking about industry change, and we're probably going to get into that discussion a bit more, but I just think it's important to understand that we have decades of public health research to show that education alone never, ever works, and that you need policy intervention, environmental change, to actually change people's behavior.
Is it possible that the educational approaches are all screwed up? Have you ever thought that maybe the worst thing about the education is the fact that it has a history, and that instead of thinking new things, all education must conform to that which has been? All educators must have been accepted by those who were before. And maybe the educational system is set up to promote inadequacy.
Well, possibly we haven't had good education. I'm willing to, you know, say, okay, let's do better education. But, you know, again, I don't think it has to be either or. I mean, it's that the evidence shows that changing the environment that one lives in by making the default more accessible, cheaper, more available, that's what really drives behavior change.
Well, I just wanted to add, we just did an experiment on education and communication in a hospital dealing with congestive heart failure. The typical readmission rate is 17%. And what we did was we used an experiment where we figured out the algebra of the mind, the words that you had to tell a person for compliance. We found that there were several different groups, different mindsets, and we had a typing tool to figure out for each patient. When we gave the patient this typing tool, we found out that the patient was in segment one. We gave the patient this specific instructions, segment two specific instructions. To make a long story short, in an A-B test, the readmission rate for the non-typed people was 17 or 18%. The readmission rate for the typed people who were given the appropriate short-term intervention upon discharge was about 5%.
And was there an industry on the other side fighting your intervention?
There was the management of the hospital, which was totally disinterested because this was not
spending billions of dollars.
They were they were just not interested in this. It's not that industry is fighting, nobody is interested.
Well, since you started again, Howard, I'll toss the question to you so that you can just, cuz it's similar with what you're saying. You spent you've had a long and, you know, well-known career developing tools that help people either find the point that something is the most delicious for them or the most marketable.
and it's a tool. And you've recently started giving talks on how that same tool could be used to market things like healthy choices.
Yes.
Or how to get people to treat themselves properly in hospitals so that they get out. Now, if it's just a tool, do tools have ethics or are they merely tools?
Tools are simply tools. And they could be used for good or they could be used for evil. You can tell a person how to comply in the language that she or he needs to hear and they'll comply. Or you can use it to twist people's minds to vote in a certain way. But I, as a tool developer, and anybody who develops tools, cannot be held responsible for the ultimate use of that. I think it's not fair. It's like saying to somebody who manufactures a rifle, you cannot build a rifle because, God forbid, it could be used to kill somebody. If you were to do that, then you shouldn't make bricks either, because there might be some lunatic who will take a brick and smash somebody on the head and kill him.
You want to go first? Yeah, no, I just want to respond to that. I think this is a very complex, important issue. We know we're at the start of what's going to be a massive exploration into brain and neuroscience. And for the first time, the public sector is now doing what many in the private sector have done, starting to appreciate the importance of taste and flavor and brain science and how they're linked to emotion and action and all of these things, which has taken a long time. And the reason I raise it is because I think there is an ethical issue here. What struck me was that when one looks at the ethical guidelines for universities in doing brain and neuroscience in the area of food, the requirements really focus on one thing, safety, minimizing safety issues, and then maybe you'll find something terrible and how you're going to deal with it. They don't look at the intent of the research. And I think that one of the things we need to be making sure, because given that most of the food company and sensory perception companies will actually be working with universities, a very high proportion, we need to ensure that the ethics of neuroscience in the area of food makes a very clear distinction between research to bring about a new fun flavor, which may increase obesity, as opposed to those aimed at going in the opposite direction, reducing some of the damages of food. And as far as I know, that's never been looked at or taken seriously.
Christina? I'm just curious about that, just to follow from that point, Derek. Do you feel like the ethics, I mean, when research is generated, it's mainly through scientific curiosity, and so I think it's hard to control what's done with it or what comes out of it. And so how would you actually dictate, you know, the kinds of questions that are being asked and how it be used?
Well, I think a research question which could be related to how do molecules or parts of the brain work to in relation, if for example you have a natural sweetener, I think looking at the role of a natural sweetener in matching a sweetener that's already on the market, I think would be fall in my category of ethical, where the intent is to lower the total calories. Whereas just generally looking to research just done generally to advance general knowledge around how we might understand addiction becomes quite dangerous if it's done in an open-ended way, because then it can be put to abuse by others.
This sounds so impossible. I mean, these are all wonderful thoughts. First, do no evil, and then everybody should be singing Kumbaya. But how do you deal in a world where biological creatures, we're trying to maximize our own benefits, our own good living? We're not all Dr. Albert Schweitzer, and from what I heard, he wasn't such a good guy either. How do we end up guaranteeing, unless we're God, how do we end up guaranteeing that the benefits of our knowledge will not be used for evil? I mean, my God, you know, this is like deliver us from evil. And we're not, you know, we're not J. Robert Oppenheimer who said, my God, you know, when he saw the hydrogen bomb, I have seen death. I don't think any. By the way, I don't think any researcher doing a taste test says that.
Well, I think we could have said the same around a lot of the general pharmaceutical research, and clearly they're finding things which could either poison you or change activities, have negative impacts, or have undesirable effects. But I think we've evolved as a nation, as a culture, to actually have checks and balances in place. And I'm saying that I think the same checks and balances that we have in place for other areas of pharmaceutical neuropsychological research should be applied to the food sector as well.
How much of that is realpolitik, which evolves just so that people can live with each other? And how much of that is forethought?
I don't mind. I'm interested in the outcome. If the outcome continues to be a benefit to society, I hope that's the direction we'll go in.
You mentioned addiction in relation to food, which is interesting. You know, your former work on tobacco policy, for instance, equating tobacco and food and legislation on tobacco with legislation on food seems like a slippery slope to go down. Do you want to talk a little bit about how they're different and how they're similar and what it means to apply the label addiction to something that can be consumed without detrimental effect by a good number of people?
Yeah, I think the question of whether food meets the strict criteria of addiction, I think, is still out there. There will be some who say that it may. I think habituation would be the way most would characterize it. But I think in tobacco, it's an interesting time to ask me the question, because when we started a lot of the work, the evidence was coming out around how the tobacco industry already framed cigarettes as being nicotine delivery devices, and they wanted to maximize them as nicotine delivery devices. Over time, what we've learned is that nicotine per se, while being addictive, doesn't seem to have any other particular harms. And I say that quite realistically, based on the use of NRTs for the last 30 years and a wide range of other studies, even going back to the first Central Journals report. The problem was that the other stuff, the tobacco, was killing you, and they needed to find a way of getting the tobacco out. And so we're actually at this very interesting point now where we are separating our policies on tobacco from nicotine and recognizing that, yes, there's going to be an addictive propensity which may continue in some, but if you take the harm down, that would be fantastic. The people are dying because of the tobacco, not because of the nicotine. So is there an analogy to food? I don't think there's an analogy directly in terms of the addictive issue, but there may very well be. Just think about the way we often think of diet sodas. Diet sodas are supposed to confer the same pleasure and taste and whatever hydration of a normal soda with presumably zero calories and zero harm. Well, I think that is a good thing. And it's equivalent of an e-cigarette relative to a cigarette, zero harm with a pleasure. But how do we react often as a society, and how do consumer groups react, and how do many NGOs react? They react in a way in which it actually fights against the larger use of diet as a replacement for full calorie on the grounds that maybe there's a cancer risk, maybe they're suppressing something, maybe the evidence is being hidden, despite the fact that every single time there's a review of the evidence, it comes out showing that there is no cancer risk. I mention that because unless we're willing to address the perception alongside the real risk, we won't make progress.
Just a quick response to the diet soda thing. So I would disagree with you that that's the public health response. Actually, the policies that I see are all focused on sugary beverages. So the tax proposals that are out there are on the calorie drinks and not on the diet sodas, which I'm not sure is such a great idea. I don't think we know fully what the potential risks are of diet soda. But on the issue of the analogy of tobacco or addictiveness, first of all, I don't think addiction gets to the heart of the matter. And that's because of how I also worked in alcohol policy. So I know a lot about the role of addiction in that issue. And there's a misperception that addiction is the main problem when it comes to alcohol. And it's not. Actually, most of the problems related to alcohol harm are in overconsumption. And it's the same thing with food, right? So it doesn't really matter to me that much whether there's an addictive quality to certain foods or not. The issue is really overconsumption and what's driving that. And while the substances are obviously different, actually I think food is more analogous to alcohol because it's a matter of degree. There's no good reason to be smoking. I think what's important is to focus on the tactics. So the tactics, no matter what industry we're talking about, are the same. And the policies that can help reduce overconsumption are very similar. So price, access, advertising, those are the three pillars of public health, right? reducing the price of harmful products, reducing access, and reducing harmful advertising. Those cut across tobacco, alcohol, and food. And those are the lessons to be learned. And then the tactics, marketing, lobbying, PR, distract, look over here, don't look over there, those are the same across the board.
I do think you were talking about the scientific pursuit and what we should be studying and how productive is it to figure out if food is generally addictive. I think it's really important to figure that out, and we don't know. We definitely, it's an open question right now. And I think it has implications, although I agree with you, Michelle, that this is still a problem regardless if food is addictive or not. It would have an interesting effect on public perception, right? And so the idea of cigarettes, you know, marketing an addictive product to children among the public, right, that there's a feeling there that, it's not such a great idea. And so I think it's a game changer in the sense of how people think about food and probably a game changer in their support for policies to regulate food.
Howard, do you want a short bite of that?
I wanted to talk to something that Michelle said. All right, you're right. Food is bad. Too much food is bad. So give me what we're going to do. You have price and access. How are we going to do it? Give me, let's go through the entire supermarket, doing the products I worked on first, and tell me exactly how to price each one. Tell me exactly how to restrict access to each one and how to communicate to each one. And, you know, you don't have to do it tomorrow, but within the next year, I need a game plan to know how I, as the almighty poobah of food, am going to do this, because I buy 100% into your argument. Now I just need a game plan.
Can I just give a very brief answer? I mentioned earlier that I work with a group who do this, and in fact, one of the team from South Africa who's part of scanning up to 10,000 products in the retail store did it. It's doable. And basically, they used the WHO and some standard criteria and some common sense and came up with a list of the 10,000 products, which would include everything that you would, if I had to ask you, what would you consider healthy food? We're not asking you to consider what's unhealthy food. That is a big difference, and that gets more complex. But think of what is healthy food. You'd all say whole fruits and vegetables and nuts and grains and you may set cereals, but then you'd set salt and sugar levels, which mean most on the shelf wouldn't make it, but they may very well reformulate to come in. Milk, you know, you're going to put in some of the lower stuff, maybe lean cuts of meat. Ostrich in South Africa, quite nice, and so on.
Not for the ostrich.
And discount those. That wasn't a, I mean, it was a big deal, but it's doable. So I don't know. And then it gets marketed in the store, it gets made clear, it gets promoted, it gets put into recipes. It's not a complicated thing to do.
That's the simplistic approach. Give me a list, you know, the index of prohibited foods.
Like no, this isn't prohibited food. These are encouraged foods.
Encouraged foods is the inverse. But I'm asking something different. I'm looking at Michelle and saying, okay, we can differentially price. Tell me how to price each of these.
So is your argument because it's too hard, we shouldn't try?
I don't know. I don't even know what to
just
do.
Just discount the whole lot. That's what you do. Discount the whole lot. That's what they did. All of them. 25% discount. It works. 10,000 products across all these. It's not complicated.
So what you're saying is let's get rid of everything but a core set. My God, that's already
called. No, keep the choice. People can go and buy whatever they want. But if they're going to buy healthy foods, they know that they're going to get a discount on the price. And does that change consumption? Yes.
Yes, it will.
And the study has been done in 250,000 people followed for 2 years, the largest public literature on this in the world by 100-fold. My question is, why don't we have 1,000 such studies?
That's a very good point. Why not?
So I just want to respond to that because I'm curious why we don't. And part of the concern is we actually do have the roadmap. Derek's right. We could tell you a whole bunch of ways to structure the grocery store. We actually know how to get people to eat healthy. And from a behavioral perspective. So I think what's tricky about these interventions, and what I'd be curious to hear from you, Derek, is how do you incentivize stores on a large scale to actually do it? There are these examples of partnerships with researchers working together, but you don't see large-scale movement in that direction.
You do the sums right. You value the cost of health correctly, and you realize that if people start eating healthily, there will be an intimate link between long-term hospitalization, healthcare costs, and you build the savings into the cost of the increases, and that's the way the program works. It's not just in South Africa, by the way. It's now here with a wide range of other retailers and hopefully be expanded. The federal government could be playing an enormously useful role. The states could be. We've got these experimental things around the country, but they're still nowhere at the scale that would have a big impact. And think what it does. When you start when you're discounting, you're also increasing consumption of those things. So you obviously got to make sure you watch portion size so you don't overshoot people's intake of good things. You can get up too much of a good thing as well. But you're creating the cadre, the interest among the farming community to actually grow some of the things. And so the incentive structures start going in the right direction.
Yeah, to me it's about changing the incentives of our economy. Right now, I mean, we have agricultural policy that drives farmers to focus on basically two crops, corn and soy. I mean, it's crazy. Most of that's going into animal feed, right? That's not feeding the world, that's feeding animals, okay? And so that's just one example of how we don't think holistically about our policies and how they can help move things in a more positive direction. So, and what I want to see is more internalization of costs. Right now, all the costs of healthcare are externalized, which is the way economists talk. And so, you know, the likes of McDonald's and Taco Bell and Kraft don't have to worry about their healthcare costs, except perhaps for their own employees. But, you know, imagine if these companies had to worry about the actual cost of producing beef on the environment, on public health. I mean, that would just be a whole different system. I think there are all kinds of ways you could rethink the way we're currently going about things. And just because it's too hard isn't a reason not to do it.
This one too, Christina. So a lot of your work is in academic. You don't come down with ethical opinions very often. But a lot of your work has to do with the effectiveness of marketing, specifically big business marketing on children in the realm of food. Make an ethical statement now. Is it ever ethical to market towards children? Is it inherently unethical, even if you were selling something like carrots or Captain Vegetable or whatever they used to push on the Saturday morning cartoons?
Part of the beauty of being a scientist is I can just look at the data and tell you the facts. I can share my opinion on this topic. So I've done some research that shows, you know, kids can be very influenced by marketing. It's no big surprise. And so one question out there is, okay, if we know how to market junk food, can we take those same tactics and just try to market healthy food to kids? And Derek raised the point that we don't even know if that would work. But from my perspective, I'm thinking practically here. I think obesity is a huge issue. We have to start somewhere. We have to try some things. And so I personally feel like, you know what, let's go for it. Let's try to figure out how to market healthy foods. Let's use those same strategies and see if we can make it work.
So I disagree with my compatriot over here from Harvard. I've written a lot about this. And basically, it's both immoral and probably illegal to market to children, period. So I think it's really important to understand that the law does not care what you are marketing to a child, or rather, what you are marketing in a deceptive way, right? So the law doesn't say, well, if you're going to market something in a deceptive way, it's okay to market deceptively carrots, but not okay to market deceptively cookies, okay? So, and the idea here is that if a child cannot understand she is being marketed to, then that is inherently misleading. And the law does not allow inherently misleading advertising to take place. It does not get First Amendment protection. So the substance of the product, whether it's a carrot or a toy or a cookie, does not matter. And that's just, you know, law 101. From a moral perspective, it's still wrong for the same reason. Because if a child can't understand they're being marketed to, you're basically exploiting them. Now, on the practical issue, again, I go back to, you know, what I was saying before. It's like, okay, we have billions of dollars over here, our industry peddling the junk food to kids, and then, what, some educational program putting Elmo on a banana. You know? I mean, it's crazy making. And now industry says, oh, well, no worries. We're going to market. We, industry, are going to decide what's healthy, and that's what they're doing. They've set up guidelines. They made a whole new announcement this morning. They're going to do this globally, what they've pledged to do in the United States. We're going to market healthy food to kids, which they define, you know, of course, in their own way. But I just really think it's important to be looking at this issue, first of all, as fundamentally moral, and it is immoral to be marketing to children. And again, from a legal perspective, it's wrong as well.
What about marketing toys to children and books? Can you ever go wrong morally marketing a toy to a child?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I encourage everyone to check out one of my favorite organizations, the Campaign for Commercial-Free Childhood, and that is their agenda, to stop marketing to children, period.
How do you get them to read books?
You have to market to kids to get them to read? I don't know. Most parents I know just read to their kids, and that's how they get them to read.
Yeah. Quite a few years ago, when I was still at the World Health Organization, we actually had a meeting involving the group from California, the group focused on trying to stop marketing to kids. And it was held at Benetton corporate headquarters. And the rationale there was that I wanted the creative designer, Oliveri Toscani, to help us build social marketing platforms to address the healthy issues. And this dilemma came up. They really struggled in the meeting to say, well, you know, are we not going to then allow the healthy marketing? And Benetton, as many of you may know, they realized a long time ago one sweater feels much like any other sweater. So the way they were going to sell sweaters was through supporting social causes. And they chose them very carefully. They were very hard-hitting social causes until he's lost his job in running a death penalty campaign, anti-death penalty thing in the U.S., which didn't go down too well among the sweater users. But that's another story. I think the reality, though, is that whether it's moral or ethical is a tough question. I think the real question isn't, for this country, isn't whether it's moral or ethical. That would be very nice if it was the question. The question is, what is supported under the First Amendment? And how do you deal with the real reality that the First Amendment is obviously a huge protection for many reasons, for many people's liberties, but is a hindrance to a lot that one might want to do in public health compared to other countries around the world? That's why you've got almost impossible to find warnings on tobacco packs, as opposed to having very big warnings very explicitly saying what the risk is and showing you visual pictures. That's why you've got continued advertising of tobacco products in all sorts of magazines, and the only constraints were actually under a voluntary agreement, not under a legal agreement because of the First Amendment. So I think, you know, what I think we do need to think of is how do you dial up what is possible under the First Amendment, which is much more effective campaigns around the positive sides, the healthy foods, but not done by corporations alone. I mean, I've spoken to a lot of people who are selling healthy products, whether it's the bird's eye people selling vegetables, and you may not like frozen vegetables, but hopefully you'll see the nutrient value actually is better than often than in the fresh stuff. But whatever it is, linking the companies who are selling what you might regard as pretty good, kosher, healthy foods with government voice stepping up their action, I think would have a huge impact. And we know it has when it's been done in tobacco control. But it costs a lot of money. And that's where the problem has been. There was a few years ago when the Verb campaign, remember Verb, was cut from the CDC budget. Maybe it was cut because it was being so effective, but many people in public health inside the agency, my understanding, were concerned it just cost a lot of money. Yes, it costs hundreds of millions of dollars, but what is the impact? And how long do you need to sustain and do these? We don't have a strong government voice on what constitutes healthy food on a continuous, exciting basis, with the exception of Michelle Obama coming up now and again reminding us about what these things are. We don't, whereas in many parts of the world, this is part of the funding of strong social services and protection services. The beauty of going that route is that it encourages, it creates an umbrella for companies who want to build healthy platforms to actually have a better chance of selling their healthy platforms because consumer resistance is being reduced and demand is being created.
Just a quick correction, Derek. It's not really the First Amendment that's the barrier to advertising restrictions. It's industry challenging regulation that then leads to the court decisions to say, well, actually, we think the First Amendment protects advertising. So I just think it's important to understand that it's industry who decides to challenge these laws. And, of course, under, you know, the First Amendment protection, but it's not like the First Amendment by itself ever protected advertising. It was only when industry challenged advertising regulation that the court agreed, unfortunately, with some of these challenges. On this idea of using money for education or, you know, for healthy marketing, you know, people don't need to be marketed to eat, right? I mean, I don't know about you, but I get hungry. That's when I eat, right? I mean, maybe if I see a commercial for a food that makes me think, yeah, I better eat. But if I see a commercial for a healthy food, that doesn't make me hungry. You know, what I'm saying is we need to get the unhealthy advertising out of the way. And then people just get hungry, right? I mean, it's especially true with marketing to children. Get out of the way of parents. That's what I say to marketers who want to do the right thing. Let parents do their job of getting their kids to eat right by stop obstructing, by stop being a barrier between the parent and their child, right? And then you don't need to be spending, you know, the little sprinkle dust from CDC on a useless verb campaign.
And last question to Derek. Your move to PepsiCo surprised a lot of people in the health community, and you wrote many and spoke many times that you felt that there was a need to push better nutrition and health from within large corporations, and this was a necessary thing that needed to happen for there to be real change in the world. How do you feel about that now, one? At two, do you feel that the corporations actually have a genuine desire and need, feel that they need to get better at this? Or, as many people posit, do you feel that it's more of a marketing canard to co-opt health? And finally, if you can make a difference from within, does it really matter what the CEO thinks about what you're doing?
Let me start with the first. It absolutely matters about what the CEO thinks, and I wouldn't have joined if I hadn't looked deep into the eyes of the CEO and saw somebody who has a very clear moral compass, and whether you agree or disagree, I mean, I think Indra Nooyi knows exactly where she would ideally like to go. Remember, by the time I joined, she had been the chief financial officer and sold off Taco Bell, Kentucky Fried Chicken, and Pizza Hut, and being the person who bought in Tropicana and Quaker in probably the biggest transformation of a food company. She already had David Kessler on the advisory board, as well as Gro Harlem Brundtland on the advisory board, so pretty good company to join with an offer to say, let's transform the company and build a global R&D agenda. What did I learn fundamentally was that it's tough. But I was just saying to colleagues that it reminds me of being in WHO was not necessarily easier. You have to have a punitive ego to want to survive being inside a place where you're going to be an area of discomfort. But I think for all of us in public health who really want to make change, it's you're going to make a bigger change moving from your comfort zone where you don't have to make the arguments which are being challenged every minute of the day, to moving into an area of discomfort where a small change can have a huge impact and start growing the cadre of people who start supporting you. I found that there were extraordinary areas of support within the company for the change. There were often structural realities. There was a recession that came from 2008 and started gouging out the potential of change because consumers were demanding cheap calories, basically. But the R&D agenda continued, and the targets and goals are inevitably going to be achieved over the next few years. It's a question of when, not if. So do I regret it? Absolutely not. I think it was a privileged opportunity to get the insight into how a large corporation works and what are the daily constraints. I think we all benefit from understanding that and realize that you don't have one uniform voice. But I think that the key is also to think long-term about how you build stronger relationships between the inside and the outside voices, not necessarily in public fora like this, but where you would have the chance to realize that marketing people struggle to know, why can't I, damn it, get my hummus sales up to my soda sales? Or why is it that the yogurt stuff is just not flying off the shelves, even though it's got every nutrient quality compared to my full-calorie Pepsi? And I think many of this room would have ideas about how to do that. Or what level do I really need to go down to on my salt when the competitor refuses to go down further? These are the kind of issues that come up day after day after day.
So pick up on the competitor issue, I think, is really interesting. And I think it is challenging for any company that wants to do the right thing or be out in front when the competition isn't. And so my answer to that, and Derek would love to hear your reaction, is that's why we need policy change, because policy is what levels the playing field for an entire industry. So why is it that companies don't seem to want to go along with that plan? I thought it was a great idea. You know, you want to be out in front, then go get the government to require it for every company.
I think all companies in all sectors try and avoid regulations because they're seen they're being boxed in and they're being constrained. That's the nature of every single business. So I think when they realize the game's up and they do realize they're going to be at a competitive disadvantage, they'll either form a voluntary agreement to move ahead, and as we've seen with a number of the issues on sodas. In the ideal world, you're right, but that's not the way it seems to work.
All right, then. I can't help myself. So do you believe that big industry could be a legitimate partner in conjunction with... I said, do you? I'm asking.
Oh,
do you
you're
believe,
asking.
Yeah, could they be a legitimate partner in conjunction with governmental regulation?
Yes. I do think there is a potential role for industry to make meaningful change. And I'm not going to say, you know, industry can't do anything right and we need government regulation all the time. I actually think, you know, it's impossible to get the federal government to move on anything, mostly because the companies are obstructing it. But I'm not against voluntary action. I'm against pretending to make voluntary change and making it sound meaningful. So, you know, if you want to do the right thing, then let's talk. And I do work with certain sectors of industry. For example, in the alcohol industry, there's the distributor tier that actually is in favor of public health because we have a common goal. Okay, so that's the key. It has to be a common goal and it has to be real and has to be meaningful. It can't be PR.
I don't think it's going to happen. I'll tell you why. It's very simple. Economics. When you have a person in a company, the person is judged on profits. And you can measure profits. But when you have wellness, how do you measure wellness? How do you measure this intangible, feel-good wellness? You can measure a corporate performance on how much it sells. And in fact, you may have all sorts of wonderful kumbaya feelings in the corporation, but give it a year or two and the ups and downs, the vagaries of life, and all of a sudden, somehow along the line, that wonderful kumbaya feeling evaporates, because health can't be measured in the same way as corporate profits and corporate performance. And if you want to know why in history, look at the Roman Empire. It started out wonderfully. Everybody was equal. All of the citizens were noble, the Gracchus brothers, etc. And 1,000 years later, you have vicious tyrannies, you have debaucheries, etc. This is the natural course of life, and it's the course of life of business versus ethics. Selling health is a wonderful thing. We all feel good, but you can't take it to the bank.
I say quickly, I don't think it's just necessarily health. So, you know, there are food companies who source their ingredients organically, who pay their workers a living wage. There are all kinds of values that certain food companies have, companies in general have. Right? I mean, it doesn't have to just be, oh, we can't measure health, so we can't possibly... You know, I'm thinking of a cereal company like Nature's Path. They put a little too much sugar for my taste in some of their products. But the point is, all their products are organic. The guy gets calls all the time to get bought out by the likes of Kellogg, and he says, no, I'm going to stay independent because that's my value and it's important to me.
Wait till his or her grandchildren are offered...
Children are involved.
Wait till the grandchildren. Very rarely does it go generation after generation. And all you need is one simple slip and back to making America fat again.
No, wait till the end. I'll make one slip.
So before we take a couple questions, we're going to do closing statements. We'll go in reverse order this time.
Okay, three brief comments. Change is happening. The soda consumption rate has been dropping for a decade. The calorie per unit has dropped dramatically. 6 trillion calories have been taken out of the food supply. And I agree 1,000% with Michelle that unless we have independent audit of these pledges, they are worthless. This is the first mega pledge made by 16 food companies to transform. And the independent audit cost a lot of money, paid by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, Barry Popkin as the lead evaluator. The early results, I'm sure they'll be published soon, show that they exceeded their results. That is a huge confidence builder for industry to do things right and to realize that they actually will occasionally get praise when they do it right. I think the other key point that Howard made is the need to link these changes to the performance and the bonus structures of the chief executives. And certainly in PepsiCo, the goals on lowering salt, sugar, and fat are linked in part to the CEO and the chief scientific officer. There was an effort to try and cascade it down into the across the company. I'm not sure how far that's got. But that is the ultimate proof, because once people know that their bonus structure is linked to them meeting a goal, they will meet it. It doesn't matter what it takes. The last point to say is that I think the world has changed. And I sit in a range of meetings with another hat on, involving many of the lead people in the investment world, whether it's BlackRock or CalPERS or Deutsche Bank or UBS, Bank of America, Merrill Lynch. They are all starting to pore over the reports of food and beverage companies in different ways, looking not just at their water use and their energy use, but looking at their potential contribution to obesity and recognizing that that represents a long-term financial risk. So they're trying to say, which are the companies out there that represent the minimal long-term risk or the potential solution to the obesity problem, recognizing what's coming? And if anybody doesn't believe this is happening, read the latest Bank of America Merrill Lynch report that ranks companies by who is making the most progress. Those reports, I would argue, go far further than many of the epidemiological studies that many of us are involved in, because they get read by the investor community and by the CEOs.
Yeah, so I agree with that. I do think some really exciting change is happening. You see some very positive movement among the food industry, even in terms of the policy discussions. At the same time, when you look at the targets set by the World Health Organization in terms of non-communicable diseases, really what they set out to do is they're hoping that we have no increase in prevalence. It's not even a reduction in obesity. Like, let's just stop it from getting even worse. So I think there's still a lot to be done. And I think the contrast here, there's this false dichotomy. You know, can big food do it on its own, or do we need government regulation? And I think the reality is, in most situations, it's probably a combination of both, right? We don't live in a black and white world. And so I think there is room for companies to make progress, and I think we are going to need some policies in place. Hopefully those policies are well designed, and they can work in conjunction with, you know, great efforts like the Healthy Weight Commitment and other industry strategies.
I wish I could live another 65 years and come back here and say what really happened. I'm not as optimistic as my colleagues. I think we have all goodwill, all good feelings. That's what happened in World War I, by the way. It was just a comedy of errors leading to millions of deaths. I think that companies operate, again, as I said before, on profit and performance. And I think wellness operates on goodwill and hope. And I think we're counterposing two things: the momentary life of a person in a company, and that changes, but the goal is always keep my job, versus our social welfare. And I think over time, we're going to have small slippages in companies, and many of these wonderful goals will go away. We'll have forgotten. They'll be transformed, transmuted into something else, but always because of the economic requirements. And I think long term we're going to be facing the same problem 10, 20, 30, 40 years from now, because we're trying really to create a machine that countervenes nature. Nature is maximized locally. Whatever you call it, the company maximizes locally. Indra will leave and somebody else will come in. People will forget their oaths of goodness, but always with the need to keep their job and make a profit. And I think I don't want to sound negative. I just think it's a lot harder. And, you know, I like to sing Kumbaya and not have World War III. I didn't want to have World War I or World War II. But they happened. Why? Here were the best and the brightest in Europe. With, you know, brilliant minds. And we slid into World War I. Why? That's natural. And that's what's going to happen also in the food industry. And I know Michelle is going to beat me up after we leave.
Just the World War metaphor is in my head. Well, it's funny because I'm not usually the cheerful one in the crowd. I'm usually the one who's like, forget it. We don't have a chance. But, you know, I think what's missing from this conversation where I want to wind up my remarks is with the community. And, you know, we're all having kind of an intellectual conversation here, but people are really suffering. And I think it's important to just take a moment and remember that this is not an intellectual debate for a lot of people who are suffering in communities every day, who don't have access to healthy food, whose communities are, you know, flooded with tobacco, alcohol, and junk food. And they're not really interested, Derek, in the data that's coming out about the 6 trillion calories. You know, they need solutions where they live. And there's a lot going on in those communities that have nothing to do with the likes of Nestle or Kraft. And I think those people really need our support and engagement. And I just really want to put that into the atmosphere and discussion that we need more learning from the people in these communities, because without them at the table, we're not going to make any real change.
And now comes the time for questions.
We have two mics, so I guess if people can line up at this one, it's probably more efficient.
Hi, Howard. My name is Lauren Nelson. So to have educated consumers, it seems like you have to have full knowledge of what's in food and the consequences of those ingredients, especially when it comes to processed foods. So I'm just curious about your opinions of labeling, because it seems like corporate interests are highly opposed to labeling, especially with everything that's going on in Vermont right now with the lawsuit.
Companies want what's called clean label. The less you have on the label, the better. I think it is possible to message to consumers wellness. I think corporations haven't done it because the brand managers are afraid of trying something new. But if they would apply some of the same procedures, the statistical approaches like conjoint analysis and others, to identifying the wellness messages that are positive for consumers, they can go a great distance. I think what we have is inertia and fear, uncertainty, and doubt. Nobody wants to do something new. So they go for the easiest thing, which is not have anything on the label.
Since I know everyone here has very strong opinions on labeling, their effectiveness, and whatnot, everyone should just take like 30 seconds and crack out their thoughts on this.
I want to say I agree with Howard that the less on the label, the better.
That's not all positive either.
I was struck by the enormous effort that both sides go to put on labels which have virtually no impact except in a relatively small group of pretty hyper-focused consumers.
I disagree. I actually think the literature, well, I know the literature on labeling is quite mixed, and so you do see studies where labels can actually really influence consumers. So there's some recent data, for example, on a traffic light food label in a cafeteria setting, and we're seeing long-term differences in purchases. So a traffic light is pretty intuitive, right? Red means stop, green means go. And so what that data is showing is that when it's implemented in a clear manner in a cafeteria setting, it reduces purchases of unhealthy foods and increases purchases of healthy foods.
There are tons of studies showing exactly the opposite, how these traffic lights have gone exactly the opposite to where you'd intuitively expect them to go.
Actually, some of those studies, one, for example, in the UK, just looked at two food items and had some other limitations around it. And others, there actually aren't great studies with purchasing data. There are studies on guiding stars with purchasing data in a supermarket that did show that simple labeling system was also effective at increasing foods that have more stars on it.
In my 5 seconds of highly politicized comments, have you ever gone to a supermarket How many people really read the label? Okay.
Well, this is a pretty weird group.
Do the reverse.
Well, how many do not?
How many had cookies? I want to know, how many of you had cookies?
How many people read most of the labels in your 27 minutes shopping? So, okay, well, we have a bunch of obsessive compulsives. But what I mean by that is most of the shopping you grab. The label is typically read when there's something new or you have a concern on your mind. Most people do not look at labels despite the amount of effort. At least they don't read the labels. They look at the pictures and they grab. The labels are primarily set up to identify, here's the product that you want.
One challenge to that, though, is people look at health claims, right? Companies use health claims all the time, and those are words on a product. You can almost think about them as labels. They're just labels companies put out. And so if companies are doing it, it probably works to sell food. So think about a front-of-package label. Maybe a lot of people aren't looking at the nutrition facts panel, but if you have a similar kind of front-of-package label, it can almost serve as a type of health claim.
The funny thing is, truly healthy food, no labels.
On that point on healthy, as a consumer, I'm always surprised by how the definition of healthy seems to change over time. I mean, the Time magazine this week has a cover telling us to eat butter.
It doesn't make it so.
That's true, but as a consumer, we're bombarded with conflicting advice all the time from the experts and from companies, and I just wonder, you know, will that change going forward?
Well, the way I look at that question, the question if you didn't hear it, is health information research changes all the time, so what do we do about evolving science? And, you know, look, I think I am interested in where there's common sense and overlap in the different dietary tribes, which is that we should be eating real food, right? I mean, if you happen to eat meat, okay, that's up for debate, but, you know, I think it's pretty clear that we should be eating most of our food that comes from nature and not in a box. You know, so I'm not really concerned about the fight over saturated fat versus trans fat or whatever. It's like, just eat real food, and then all that stuff kind of goes away. And how you balance it out between plants and animals, you know, duke it out.
How many people can really afford to eat real food?
That's policy. That's what we're discussing.
Actually,
how to change policy. To make that a reality.
There's actually some data on that. So a new study just came out at the Harvard School of Public Health showing that diets that include, you know, real food and healthier products are actually perceived to be much more expensive than is true in reality. You can eat for pretty much the same amount and
they
eat healthily.
Whole foods, whole check.
You've
heard that.
Does that study factor in the time value of making the food at home or no?
No, so this is pure cost, not other kinds of, like, time cost, so financial cost.
Time and stress are huge, and we can never just focus on one issue. So, you know, it's a matter of paying people a living wage, it's a matter of de-stressing our lives, it's putting an emphasis on what people really want to spend time on. You know, I just think it's so much bigger than just how to kind of dial in the proper policy to get better pricing. It's giving people an opportunity to live their lives in healthier ways in general.
But isn't that a little idealistic?
Yes, it's idealistic to pay people a living wage.
No, I didn't say that. But all of these things seem to really militate against our regular lives. Our regular lives, we have our own mental economies. We're balancing off the amount of time that we have, the amount of money that we have, the number of mouths to feed, the alternative things that we have to do. And all of a sudden somebody says, a whole chunk of this is not going to keep you well. And the real question is it possible to really do this? I know you believe it, but
what's the alternative? I mean, you know, we're in a public health crisis. Right? I mean, this is serious. We have more and more people getting sick all the time, and it's not just from poor diet, it's from poor lifestyles. Again, stress is a major factor in poor health. So, you know, again, we're just going to throw up our hands and say, well, it's too complicated, we can't fix it, this is life.
No, I keep saying, I think we have to re-educate the consumer. The most wonderful, cheapest
thing. If that
worked,
I would be with you. If it worked, great, but you know what? It doesn't.
It does. The problem is, it hasn't worked before. Post hoc is not propter hoc.
All right.
It's it just because it didn't work before doesn't mean it can't work
we
now.
Just reject decades of science because you think it can work better.
Can I interrupt?
Please.
Have you been called on?
Please.
Dan Soloway. I've been in the restaurant industry here in the city for 14 years. My mother worked for PepsiCo for 18 years, for full disclosure. But I've had the pleasure of working with the likes of Michael Anthony and Dan Barber. So I've got both the kind of conservative Republican side of my mind and the more liberal Democrat side of my mind to keep things even. But, you know, one of the things about education, Howard, is something that I refer to as a CAP study, and it's been 20 years since I went to school, and that stands for KAP is Knowledge, Attitude, and Practices. Most people who are educated have the knowledge, they have the attitude. They want to exercise, they want to eat healthy, they've read the books, the magazines, they surf the web. The P, the practices, is where we fall short. You can educate all you want, but the food is engineered to make you want to eat it. You used the word addiction before on the panel. So we know that the companies are using other companies, the PepsiCos, the Yum Brands, the Dardens, the Dunkin' Donuts, are making food to trigger your brain to have a pattern of wanting more. You can educate all you want. The people who are undereducated probably won't receive the knowledge part, so maybe or maybe not they have the attitude part, but the equation will always come down to the practices. You've got less than 2% population growth in this company, but a publicly traded or private, like an M&M Mars, needs to have 10% year-over-year profit growth in order to get Wall Street to say yay and not sell the stock. You need to overconsume as an individual to make the companies profitable. Even if the food wasn't engineered, even if we were only selling apples, those companies, you'd have to eat 10 apples a day for them to hit their year-over-year growth. So overconsumption is going to happen because it's part of the economic model. The other aspect of that is that we can now take a pill to eliminate all of our problems. So you just eat whatever you want and take Lipitor. If you want to do it naturally, you use red rice yeast, CoQ10. But we're all getting back to the same. I haven't asked a question.
Thanks, Dave.
How are you educating the people? How are you reaching the 300 million plus people? Even if you change the policy, what policy are you changing? Because Big Pharma wants everybody to be obese, because if they weren't, they would all close. So you're so interrelated. How do you get it to work? And because not everybody's eating at Gramercy Tavern in Blue Hill.
Let's look at it a little bit differently. What are the messages that I need to give you? We've never met before. What are the specific 5 to 10 things I need to text you every day so that you will want to eat better or exercise? For every person in this room, if we could know the 5 to 10 messages which would resonate with you to make you want to eat better or live better or adopt a better lifestyle, I think that would go a long way. I'm not talking about the namby-pamby education with the, blue-collar group and the photo op. I'm talking about simple, serious texting of everybody in America, the 5 to 10 things that person needs, and I guarantee you we will see a difference.
Texting.
You know what texting with a phone.
Yeah, I've heard of it, but I'm trying to wrap my head around how texting is going to overcome the,
That's the only thing that people read.
Okay.
They read.
The industry's texting them too, right? When they walk by the cookie aisle, they get a coupon.
That's correct, and I want to detox that. Detox, texting to detox.
Good luck.
My question is actually about entrepreneurship. So my name is Crystal. I work at a tech startup in the city in like a consumer device.
No, you're probably in favor of the texting solution then.
Sure.
Ask her the question. She's a lawyer.
But I think it's interesting thinking about the food industry that you guys are talking a lot about the government and really big food companies, whereas in other industries like technology, if there's a gap in a market, it takes a matter of weeks, months, or like a year for a new product or a new thing to fill in that gap. So I think it's interesting that you guys are talking about solutions like policy or changing policies of these big companies like Kraft, where, you know, Kraft started by one person or a family, whereas they were a startup to get to that place. So do you think that entrepreneurship or food startups could be a solution to this public health problem?
Huge yes, and fantastic you asked the question. I think you represent a generation that is going to see a transformation in the way that the consumers demand and consume products and services that we have no way of really appreciating sitting up here. We as part of the work we're doing, we've actually done a review of what's happening in the IT startup world that's going to lead to health promotion. And we can share some of the insights. But if you think of companies like Yumly on the web, or Revolution Foods, or a whole range of companies that are either using and maximizing the use of the internet in more innovative ways than Howard mentioned, but he's starting to hint at, linking to usable recipes, usable healthy products, but then actually devices that help you track and monitor and understand where they are. This is taking off big time, and people are using it not just in thousands, but in hundreds and tens of thousands. We suspect that the companies who are going to understand this and link to consumers and have the incentive structures right, are going to have the ability to change people's lives for the better. And it's not going to happen 5-10 years from now. It's happening literally as we speak. These company platforms are being built. So, yes, I mean, I would suggest you pursue this line. The links between focusing on IT and technology solutions, using the best of behavioral economics, not to make sure that you really remove barriers and maybe put in place economic incentives, is definitely the way of the future.
Thank you.
Okay, I have a quick question. If you don't mind, sorry.
Yeah.
We'll get you.
Yes, go.
Okay, my question will be really quick. I work in school dining, and our main objective is like sustainability and real food. So my question here is, shouldn't we have a policy that would force all the education and like schools, universities around the U.S. to offer in their dining facilities just real food and not processed food, and change the perception that organic and sustainable food is not way more expensive than regular, you know, processed food? Like, it's not the difference of like $3 a pound of meat that is grass-fed than a corn-fed, you know, beef. The difference comes from the transportation from a different state, not going to upstate New York to Hudson Valley, for example, and getting like meat from there. So it shouldn't be a policy, you know, like starting from schools and then going over to supermarkets and then going over to communities. Like start from the kids that will be like a major member of the community in the future. Thank you.
One brief response is, again, obviously, yes, I would go further. I think that a lot of programs are aimed at individual people in the workplace without looking at the food environment at the workplace. We believe strongly there's a huge opportunity to introduce better food at work that includes what's served in the cafeteria and in the vending machines, and the greater use of the kitchens to actually teach some basic cooking skills to people. If you thought about how you could lever the places people work and go to school and gather for entertainment, we're talking about the workplace, we're talking about the school environment, the hospitals. I mean, Michelle and I were both at Yale some time ago, and I remember a very obvious fast food thing in the hospital. I don't know if it's still there. I went to the Joslin Center recently, you know, for diabetes, and there were some obviously diabetogenic things being promoted in a store, right? That clearly is really not in the best interest of health and the best interest of institutions.
Yeah, I'll try and ask my question also very quickly. I'd like to present a hypothetical situation that is actually a very real opportunity that I'm confronting, which is if you had the opportunity, and I'd love to hear if there's time from all of the speakers, if you had an opportunity to provide an educational or educational plus intervention to all public school children from kindergarten through high school, what would that intervention look like? And also, what would be the outcomes that you think you could actually measure to show that you are making a substantial difference? Thanks.
I would send them to farms and I would give them some cooking classes, and I wouldn't waste any time on any educational efforts within the usual curriculum. They all fail.
Ditto.
I would do an experiment where I'd find out the messages to which these kids resonate, and I'd find the segments and identify the mindset of each child who comes in by a quick 4 or 5 question questionnaire from this study. And then I would give the child a series of messages over a year on a daily basis, just a piece of paper, and try to remold the child's mind to want to live or want to pursue wellness.
Well, not surprise you, I question the assumption in the question. And I would just get corporations out of schools, period. I don't think we should be molding children's minds. I think we should let their minds develop as they're naturally meant to. And by taking out the corporate piece, and I mean everything, you know, any kind of corporate influence in schools, there's one place that industry should not be. It's in schools. And you remove that, and then you let children learn in a commercial-free environment. And that means everything from the cafeteria to the hallways, et cetera.
Any burning last desires to make a comment?
No, but maybe you can give us some bananas next time.
Fair. thank you, esteemed panel. Thank you, guests, for coming.
Heritage Radio Network is a member-supported nonprofit organization broadcasting over 30 live shows a week. To learn more and donate, visit our website or connect with us on iTunes, Stitcher, Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram for more. Thanks for listening.